Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Helping Couples Heal podcast. This is Marnie. And before I start the actual episode, I'd just like to let you know that for any couples who are in the earlier stages of recovery that are looking for some kind of healing work to do together, Helping Couples Heal is about to launch our Bridge to Connection group, which is going to be a four-week transformative group to help couples navigate the early stages, including safety and stabilization, and helping to create a roadmap for what's ahead. And it's also a great opportunity to connect with others who are on the same path. Please email our support team for more information at support@helpingcouplesheal.com. The group starts mid-August, which is right around the corner. So if you're interested, please get in touch with us as soon as possible. All right, I'm going to start the episode now. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to the Helping Couples Heal podcast, a place for healing and hope for couples impacted by betrayal resulting from infidelity and or sex addiction. Your host is Marnie Breaker, licensed marriage and family therapist, certified sex addiction therapist, and founder of the Center for Relational Healing in Los Angeles and San Diego, California. The Helping Couples Heal podcast was launched in 2021 with the intention of bringing hope to couples all over the world who are desperately trying to recover from the devastating impact of betrayal. Realizing how many people the podcast was reaching and that we could offer even more support to our listeners, Marnie co-founded Helping Couples Heal, which has since grown into a global online coaching organization. This podcast is the foundation of all the work that we do at Helping Couples Heal. Thank you for listening. Marnie brings over a decade of experience and expertise in the field of betrayal trauma and is honored to support you wherever you may be in your healing. If you've lost hope, you've come to the right place. Now, take a slow, deep breath and let's begin with the Helping Couples Heal podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Helping Couples Heal podcast. This is Marnie, and I have a fabulous guest with us today. I know I say this all the time. I feel like every time I introduce a guest, I say something like they're amazing, they're fabulous. I guess the reality is that I bring people on this podcast who are all really pretty amazing. And I guess that means you can continue. All of you listeners should know that I'm committed to bringing on really fantastic guests always. But I'm going to be introducing somebody who I've known for many, many years. We're both certified sex addiction therapists and partner specialists through APSETS. This is a person who has coined a phrase that is relatively new in the world of betrayal trauma, and it's called betrayal violence. And many of you might now know who I'm talking about just by hearing that term. So I am excited to introduce you to Hope Ray, who has a private practice near Detroit, Michigan, and she is the creator of the Complex Partner Trauma magazine and has done some really incredible work around betrayal trauma and partner violence and betrayal violence. So Hope, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Thanks, Marnie. I'm just so excited. Every time we talk, it's hard to make a stop, isn't it?
I know.
We have so much to keep going about, that's for sure.
You know, for anyone who is familiar with your work, I think that they will know sort of off the bat that you and I do speak a similar language and that I tend to use the A word quite often, the abuse word, which is often really hard for people to hear, but which really, once people hear it and understand it and relate to it, it's a huge game changer. It really helps. And you have coined a term, betrayal violence, which, as we'll talk about, is a framework for understanding something in the bigger context. And I think that these things that we're talking about really go hand in hand. So I'm really excited to be able to have you share with people what it is that you mean when you talk about betrayal violence.
Thanks. Yeah. And you know, your use of the word abuse is something you've been doing a long time since we met back over a decade ago. And you're a testament, and there are many other colleagues of ours that are testaments to the idea that we have seen and begun filling this gap, this idea that there are power and control dynamics involved in most infidelity. When somebody holds leverage of power and control over their partner in multiple ways, which we'll get into, it's not just cheating. Cheating is egregious behavior, but it alone isn't necessarily violence or even abuse. What constitutes abuse is all the subterfuge that goes along with it. And so I appreciate so much your hunger years ago to begin finding accurate wording and definitions. And that's what betrayal violence is about, is crafting that language, that terminology that can universally apply and can be used in an interdisciplinary way too, not just by therapists, but by pastors and doctors and attorneys, so that we can understand that infidelity isn't just this kind of elusive, benign issue that happens. It's very often related to power and control dynamics, which, you know, constitutes abuse. It's a big deal, and it needs some concrete definition around it.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think when I started out in the field, and perhaps when you did as well, there was so much focus specifically on the sexual behavior, right? The sexual infidelity, the sexual acting out, the compulsivity. And there was this huge component that was missed. And one of the things I do really, really admire, and I'm so grateful to Dr. Manwala about, is, and he was my supervisor when I got into this field, so I learned this stuff right away. I love that he saw the partners. I don't know if you've ever heard the story, but we were working at a clinic in Los Angeles. He was my supervisor, and we were doing these lectures on Saturday mornings where we'd come in and there'd be a group of betrayed partners and we would talk to them about a different topic. And he came in one morning to do a topic on healthy sex and sexuality. And he got up in front of the room and he was looking at who he was talking to. And he was like, what am I doing? These people are traumatized. Like, he really, really saw the trauma. And he kind of stopped in his tracks and realized we're dealing with something much bigger than cheating. And yeah, so like my work, and I think your work, is not just focused around sexual infidelity and cheating, but it's really focused on that more acute pattern of behaviors that accompanies any kind of sexual acting out or cheating or infidelity.
Absolutely. Yeah. I believe that with as many therapists who try to shy away from couples work right off the bat when a couple comes in wanting to restore their relationship or at least trying for that after deep betrayal, couples therapists want to put that on hold until there can be individual treatment for one or both of them. But that's the container where this dynamic of power and subterfuge is held. And so it must be present and primarily focused on. It doesn't mean that a person who has cheated and betrayed their partner shouldn't also be getting ancillary support for whatever various issues they have, whether that's, you know, they need medication or they have a personality disorder, they have an addiction issue and need an addiction approach to that issue. There's many things that they might need to be doing individually, but the relational container is the place where the dynamic gets thrown off kilter. And very often there are systemic issues that already have some inequities going on or inequities at play in a relationship. But once somebody begins withholding essential information from their partner that relates to their partner's safety and well-being, they are reducing the agency of their partner. They are putting a straitjacket on the autonomy of their partner's ability to choose what they partake in this relationship. And in doing so, they accumulate power for themselves and control. This is a tricky conversation. I'm sure we'll get into it, but you know, many people who are doing this often are men and often don't intend to cause this kind of harm and trauma for their partners. Most of the time, I believe they're trying to avoid consequences. They're trying to essentially keep life as normal as possible while they're behaving abnormally. But regardless of their intentions, they still cross over into abusive territory. And so that relationship is absolutely important to offer primary support and focus to, because otherwise we just kind of prolong these inequitable dynamics in the relationship.
I think it's worth actually speaking to something you just said, this idea that it's going on, no matter how we look at it, it is going on, those power differentials, right? The domination and control. But it is not necessarily something that is happening because a person wants to cause harm to another person. And I think that that is something that gets very confusing when we deal with clients, with betrayed partners particularly. I did a presentation the other day for a very large group of betrayed partners. And one of the questions that was asked was, is it a choice? Aren't they making a choice to do this? And you know, I always acknowledge it. The impact is the same on some level, right? Like it happened. So that doesn't change anything. And yes, it's a choice to decide to withhold information because I don't want there to be consequences, right? But that is true. There is a choice in
wanting to keep a secret and then having to behave in ways to keep that secret. But I don't think, at least for the majority of the addicts or betrayers that I've worked with, have made a choice to intentionally hurt their partner or their family.
Yeah. So the way I describe that is very similar. And I love and resonate with what you're saying. There are fidelity violators who are also coercive controllers. They absolutely intend to dominate, demoralize, diminish their partners.
Yes.
Want to reduce and restrict the liberties of their partners. They want their partners to be ultra dependent and be cut off from resources, to be isolated. And they are seeking to dominate and create this power and control regime for themselves because that's what they're motivated to do. And they also might cheat. But in those cases, the betrayal violence we should consider to be ingrained into a larger system of intimate partner violence or domestic violence, meaning that the cheating is one of multiple concerns that creates a power dynamic. And so really, it's not the primary focus. The primary focus for a person who is victimized in that way by that type of coercive control really needs, you know, safety and all sorts of support in that regard. So then there's the fidelity violators who are not coercive controllers. And it doesn't mean that they're perfect individuals and always have the best intentions. But in general, they tend to really love their partners. They find themselves in a snowball effect of their lying and deception over years and years. Oftentimes are living outside of reality with their compartmentalization of, you know, not really experiencing consequences because they haven't had to because everything's been hidden for so long, right? So they are way down this path and oftentimes hating a lot of it themselves. And therefore, they aren't really trying to ruin their partner's life. Instead, they are working to not do that, to not give their partner this thing that they worry their partner can't handle, not blow up their family, not blow up their own reputation. Many of these fidelity violators might just want to have their cake and eat it too. But also there's a lot of folks who find themselves in these situations and by their own choices, don't really know how to extract themselves from the dishonesty that's accumulated over the years. And so they do have choice. And every lie is a choice. Every time they violate fidelity is a choice. And the intentions behind keeping all this information from their partner generally is self-protective, self-preserving in nature. So it's nothing noble. But at the end of the day, they really aren't setting out to dominate, diminish, and demoralize their partners.
Right. And what's important to recognize is that regardless of the intention to do that, that is what happens. That is the experience of the betrayed partner. And so for the fidelity violator, they have to learn once they are caught, once they're discovered, once they decide that they want to get help, part of their work is to learn about what they have done and to be able to tolerate the language and really own it and be able to acknowledge that, yes, they did make these choices. They didn't do it with contempt or desire to hurt someone or blow someone's life up. But regardless of what their intention was or what their thought process was, this is what's happened. And now they have to experience and live the consequences of that and repair that. Those are pretty much the people that we work with in our field. Like, I don't see very much the kind that you were talking about when you first talked about it, which is really more like under domestic violence, wanting to isolate the partner, make the partner really dependent on them. That could happen. But generally speaking, those are not the people that I'm seeing in my practice.
That's right. Yeah, I think the majority of us who specialize with affairs and infidelity issues are not seeing coercive controllers in our office. They tend to not go to therapy. They tend to not have great results because the willingness is often not there. But we see a different story with fidelity violating people who have blown their lives and the lives of their partners and families up, but also need a lot of help organizing two things. One is whatever sexual problem they may have that needs support, help, exploration and examination, structure. And the second piece is their abusive behavior and communication that unfolded over the course of so long that they developed this one-up position. And, you know, essentially, if they're going to restore parity in their relationship or give it a fair go for the first time, perhaps, then they have to rehabilitate that abusive behavior, the things that undergird their ability to live a duplicitous life, to withhold information that is essential for their partner to know. And so that rehabilitation work is, you know, something I'm passionate about. And there are very few models. You've mentioned Omar Manwalla. He has an excellent methodology that addresses both sexual problems and the what he calls integrity abuse, right? The compulsive, entitled sexuality alongside that integrity abuse. That's what his program is about. It's a methodology that seeks to tackle these issues for men who fit that bill. So there's not a lot of other programs or methods out there. But betrayal violence is still different than that in the sense that it's not a method. It's a way to describe what's going on. It's a zoomed out picture of what is most infidelity and what exactly qualifies something as betrayal violence.
All right. Well, then let's dive into that. Let's get a little bit more specific and have you answer that question.
Okay. So betrayal violence is defined by three modes of conduct. It's not defined by gender, by the type of sexual situation that's happening. It's defined by these three things. Number one, a person maintains a relationship with their significant other, while number two, secretly and repeatedly violating fidelity. And then number three, uses abusive behavior and communication, in other words, deception, gaslighting, and even exploitation to conceal that information from their partner. That's it. That's all you have to do to cross over into this territory. It's kind of scary. And it might seem extreme, but at the end of the day, we need to be able to recognize what's happening here, even at its genesis, before the power and control occurs slowly over the course of many years. It's already beginning, you know, once somebody starts keeping essential information from their partner. And I'll say this too, Marnie, that even when the cheating or the secret repeated infidelity stops, these abusive methods of deception and gaslighting often persist beyond the cheating. And there's old secrets that haven't come to light. There's information the partner still doesn't know. There's still power and control at play. So we still have a context of betrayal violence, even if somebody has become faithful. So that's all you have to do, really, to cross over into this territory. The only other thing I'll say is that you must be able to benefit from the leverage of that power and control. And so a whole nother conversation would be about the type of person who is actually entrapped by their partner's coercive control, yet they cheat. Meaning, let's use an example of a woman who is coercively controlled by her husband. If she's cheating and also keeping secrets about it, that's not good behavior. That's not, you know, something that we would consider to be healthy. Might be very understandable. But at the end of the day, it's not betrayal violence. And that's because she doesn't have access to the leveraging power of that control and ability to, you know, create an abusive environment because she's already existing underneath that kind of regime. And so that's part of why we need to differentiate this, because it can get weaponized for people who already have a lot stacked against them when it comes to the type of power and control they're living under.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I do think that something you brought up is worth kind of coming back to and reinforcing, because I think it gets missed a lot, which was that the sexual behavior, whatever that is, can stop completely. And there could even be months or even years of sobriety or abstinence from that behavior. And often we do see that those patterns of behavior, the integrity violations, we see those continue. Dr. Manwalla calls that the symptom progression phase. It's later, you know, after the exposure of the sexual behavior and that stops, there's still the ongoing patterns of abuse. And it could be minimizing, gaslighting, stonewalling, transferring blame, you know, being verbally abusive in some way, minimizing all the stuff that we see. And so what often happens, at least what I see, is that the person that caused all of this often tries to focus on, well, look, I've been sober for X amount of time. And again, without people like you and I coming back in and saying, no, there's so much more. Right? There's this other side of this that's not just about the sexual betrayal, and you have to own that. We have to speak about it, because I see so much pain in my clients who come in and say, I don't understand why my husband, he wants me to just get over this because he's been sober, but it doesn't feel sober. You know, he talks a lot about the word recovery. I'm in recovery. I'm in recovery. And it doesn't feel like recovery. I'm still feeling abused.
That's right. Because that dynamic is still at play. It doesn't get fixed just because the fidelity violators become faithful or become deeply empathic or really, really honest. Those are important qualities to, you know, kind of intervene on the old way of living. But at the end of the day, if they don't dissolve the power differential they've created by withholding essential information from their partner, then there can't be equity. And, you know, very often partners who've been betrayed will essentially power up to, you know, kind of protect themselves and create stipulations around how they are going to be treated going forward by their partner. But this often gets confused as some sort of power dynamic flip, and that's not accurate because the only person who can dissolve a power differential that they've benefited from because they've constructed it is the person who has constructed it. And so those equalizing measures that partners do where they appear to be in control actually get responded to by the fidelity violator who's held power and control by moving down into powerlessness. And I argue that powerlessness is actually still a form of not only inauthenticity, but of power and control. From a powerless place, you are deferring everything to your partner. You're acquiescing to your partner. You're trying to essentially put your partner in charge as a way of equalizing the way that you at one point were in charge. But what it does is it drops you down into a role that's no longer a peer. It gives your partner more labor, mental, emotional, psychological, relational labor to do, and it offloads responsibility from you. And so that powerlessness is actually the problem. It's not the fact that the partner is equalizing or resisting the abuse by powering up and setting boundaries and stipulations. The problem is still actually in the hands of the person who created that power differential in the first place. And like we talked about earlier, there are other contributing factors to this power differential. Secrets are going to be a huge way of building a power gap between you and your partner. But there may have been pre-existing power gaps or contributors to that power gap, things like male privilege and different types of systemic issues that relate to sexism and, you know, patriarchy and things like that, where there are benefits they're receiving that already kind of give them the upper hand. There's a lot to look at here, but infidelity, most often when it's accompanied by that deception, that gaslighting, that exploitive behavior, that's when we see inequity. And if we don't treat that, it will not go away, even if somebody's got their sex life in pristine condition.
How did you get so passionate about this?
You know what? Let's think about it together. I've been doing this a long time like you. I mean, when I see gaps, when I see clients who come to me who've been through so many programs and they still feel they aren't getting where they need to be. I know you've had that experience too, Marnie, and I just feel for them. I look at the amount of options they have for podcasts, for books, for programs out there, and how many different lenses. Everything is a blend of different theoretical models, but there's no framework. There's no overarching language that creates a common table for therapists and pastors and anyone dealing with this stuff to draw from. And so there's a lot of confusion. Is he a sex addict? Is he a narcissist? Is he an integrity abuser? Is he a combination of those?
Is he a sociopath?
And that's just the male population. You know,
right.
Look across all genders. There are so many different combinations of infidelity in relationships. And so we need a way to talk about all of it. And while there are so many beautiful models, Omar Manwalas is one of my favorites. There are so many incredible methodologies that are rooted in different kind of theoretical thinking and blends of attachment theory and addiction and all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, we all call it different stuff. We all think there are different means to the end. We all think the treatment path looks a little different. And that is not doing well for our clients. They are taking longer and spending more money to get the help they need. And so it's really a crapshoot for them if they can find the right therapist that they can maybe afford and that fits their finances as early on as possible. So that's why I'm passionate. I want to see there be access to information that hits the mark right away, that sorts them into the categories for treatment and support that are going to actually benefit them before they spend all their time and money in areas that feel like a waste. There are families that fall apart in the midst of that. And I don't think everyone should stay together, but I really hate to see the families go through so much crisis that could have been mitigated had they had more pointed and targeted assistance early on. And that assistance, like you and I have been saying for years, really needs to be around the power and control dynamics.
I could not agree more. And I feel equally as passionate about this as you do. And what I see a lot with my clients is the treatment-induced trauma. They come in and, like you were just saying, I mean, some of them have been on this path for years, and they come in and it's almost as though they are in an acute state of trauma that you might see in the early stage, right after an initial discovery. And sadly, it's because I think for a number of reasons, there are many clinicians, many practitioners out there who do not feel comfortable using language like abuse, integrity abuse, violations, and violence. And I thought it would be worth our time to take a few minutes to talk about why we use this language. You know, this is not to shame anybody. This is not to hurt anybody. This is not to be offensive. It's not to take revenge in some way. We do this because it's actually valuable and important in order to treat somebody who is engaging in these behaviors.
And it's the kindest way to do it. It's the least pathologizing way to do it. Because when we talk about betrayal violence, we're talking about conduct. We're not talking about pathology. We're not talking about someone's issues. We're not talking about their gender, their socioeconomic status. We're not talking about anything really about them other than their conduct. And if they are displaying and exhibiting conduct in that manner, then we have information that suggests to us that they may have constructed a power differential between them and their partner. That gives us so much information and gives that relationship so much more of a clear path to be able to navigate forward. So I don't want to see all these models and podcasts and programs need to make big changes. I just want to see them carry this betrayal violence idea through their program as a downline that says we continually assess for that power and control dynamic, and then we continue treating in the methodology that we're trained to. And I think it also holds therapists a little more accountable, by the way, Marnie, because if somebody, let's say, is a sex addiction therapist, then that means that they are trained by an organization that has taught them an approach or a method for treating sex addiction. And so that would mean that that should be the focus of the treatment. And therefore, you know, we can really identify all these different specializations and help people who are struggling with power and control dynamics from infidelity get sorted into the right treatment opportunities. It's not all sex addiction. It's not all integrity abuse. It's not all narcissism. It's not all avoidant attachment. It's a combination of many things and different things for different people. And so we can't define it any longer by the issues or the pathology behind it. We must define it as conduct. And so that's why we do that, because it's kind. It is the least shaming thing we can do to zoom all the way out and just look at someone's conduct, just like the law does. It defines what is or isn't assault, battery, breaking and entering. We need arbitrary definitions.
And there's a lot of people in the field that, again, think that it's offensive in some way, or to tell an addict in early recovery or a person who is so filled with shame because their behavior has been so egregious and they have caused so much pain to their partner and potentially their family. So they're protected by the therapist. Oftentimes, I hear things like, that's going to make him feel so much worse. That's going to bring on more shame. He's not ready to hear that. And, you know, I think that is actually so patronizing to the client or to the person, because yeah, people are so much more capable and can be so much more ready than we often give them credit for.
Yeah.
You know, people don't have to be mired in more shame. If you use responsible language and explain what you're talking about and put it into a context that makes sense, I think it's the greatest gift you can possibly give somebody who comes in and meets the criteria for what we're talking about here.
Totally. And unfortunately, I see it as quite pathologizing when therapists do that, when they protect or avoid talking to their clients about using words like violence or abuse. I think it's pathologizing because here's kind of the underlying mode of thinking that's beneath it. This person isn't healthy. This person isn't necessarily normal. They have a problem. And so I'm not going to put normal expectations on them. And we could dive into what that does to the rest of the system, like the partner. But instead of going there, I'll just say that I want to see therapists recognize how their biases here, their ideas that these people are sick, may be jumping the gun. That could be the case. There are many people who have significant mental health issues who are also facility violators. But if we start there, then we haven't given them a fair shake. Many folks who violate fidelity really don't understand that they have crossed over into abusive territory. Right. And, you know, there may be some knack to it, but essentially that information I've found to be always welcome to the person who is really wanting to restore their relationship, wanting to become trustworthy and safe for their partner again. And guess what? They've been hearing this from their partner for a long time. It makes a lot of sense when they hear it clearly defined this way.
Yeah, I'll often hear them say, you know, men will say to me, you know, this is really hard for me to hear. But the truth is, I have heard it before from my partner and I need to hear it because it's true. Again, and it's really hard to hear. And we know it's hard to hear. But as clinicians, Hope, we're given such a huge responsibility. These people are coming to us, like you said, in so much pain, so much trauma, so much grief. And we have a platform to really help them. And if we don't name what is really going on, we are not doing a service to them. We are not giving them the opportunity to understand fully their problem and to then get the help that they need. So I agree with you. I love being able to talk about this and use the responsible language because I'm a big believer that if you don't name it, you can't treat it and you can't heal it.
The first step in solving a problem is figuring out what it is. Absolutely. And so this effort of increasing awareness of betrayal violence is all about taking what we've established in the domestic violence literature and understanding how power and control, which has been well established in research, factors into infidelity, where secrets, deception, gaslighting, et cetera, are being used. And so it's not anything new, but what is new is using the word violence to talk about it that way. And I understand that's a strong word. And Marty, I think both of us would agree that if we didn't have to use that word, it would kind of be nice. Like, who wants
to
be talking about violence? At the end of the day, though, I don't talk that much with my clients about it. That word doesn't come up other than to define it. Because what we get into is the heart of the matter, which is how are we going to restore equity and maybe establish it for the first time in this relationship? Is that even possible? And so, you know, it's rewarding work when you have willing individuals. It's just fantastic stuff.
It's amazing. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to do what we do. It feels so empowering, right? Because we are empowering others. And, you know, I probably should have said this at the very beginning of this conversation, which is that I think in order for people to be able to hear these terms and hear it in a way where it can actually be valuable to them, right? Where they're going to believe it, where they're going to listen, where they're going to feel inspired to do something about it. What happens, I think, is that when we hear these words, violence and abuse, we think about what we hear about when we're growing up or what we're seeing on TV. Like, we think of violence and abuse as physical domination, throwing somebody against the wall, hitting someone, punching somebody, verbally assaulting somebody, right? Sexually abusing somebody. So when we hear these words, that's where our brain goes. And many people will say, I would never do that. That's not me. And so I think it's really important for people to be able to construct a different context in which to see these words, because these words do mean that, and they mean something else. When you use the term betrayal violence, you're not saying you have beaten up and, you know, created physical wounds and medical wounds that are going to send your partner to the hospital. And I think it's important that people understand that, because if they will only look at those words as what we see in the movies, then they're going to miss out on the benefit of understanding what we're talking about here.
You just highlighted something I'm so deeply passionate about, which is the benefit of looking at this in this manner. So many people who've been betrayed by their partners don't have those black eyes and bruises, and they experience word aversion to the idea of having been victimized or experienced violence. And word aversion in the study of linguistics is all about association. So yeah, we associate this stuff with those posters that show, you know, women who have black eyes and they have pull tabs at the bottom for you to go call the domestic violence shelter. And if that's not your experience as a betrayed partner, you are not going to necessarily size up what you've been through as abuse. You might say it's psychologically or emotionally abusive. You might understand and claim the term gaslighting as part of your reality, but it is so much more than that, because you might not have been sent to the hospital by your partner because of a head injury, but you might be at the hospital getting yourself checked for STIs. Because your safety was not disclosed to you. And so there are so many risks, financial risks, relational risks with friends, children, family members, coworkers. There is a tremendous amount of detriment that accumulates for somebody. And when that trauma comes to a full boil, somebody realizes they've been living in essentially a false context and that their agency has not been fully activated because it's been hindered and hampered in ways they didn't know. And they realize that they've been living in what feels like a subservient position with a person who's meant to be their peer, their beloved. And so it is extremely violent to experience that. And it doesn't need to get defined by someone's intentions to be that way. It just needs to be defined by the actions, the conduct that create that kind of atmosphere. And so I love that you do that. You don't shy away from it. And guess who doesn't shy away from this? The people who are doing it.
Yes, I know.
They want this information. They don't feel like it's fun to think about, talk about, work through. It's not like taking, you know, a nice drive in the country. It's deep, difficult, thought-provoking examination, and it's essential. And those who are hungry for it do it, and they change.
And it requires a certain degree of humility. Because like you just said, it is not easy. Listen, if the person that I love more than anything in the world looked me in the eye and said, you've caused more harm to me and more pain to me and more trauma to me than any person in this world ever has, and I don't know how I'll ever be the same again and if I'll ever heal from any of this, my heart would be broken. And I can't even, thank God I haven't had this conversation. Thank God, because I can't imagine how horrible it would be to tolerate seeing that person in so much pain. However, that is what this calls for. It calls for a lot of courage and humility to be able to stand there and to feel inside like, I can't believe that I did this, and have all those feelings, right? All of the guilt and the shame and all of that stuff. But when the person is able to stand there anyway and recognize how awful it feels, but how important it is, and the reparation that can happen and the healing that can happen as a result of tolerating it, the result of saying, oh my God, yes, I did this. Yes, I caused violence to my partner. It doesn't have to be the violence we see in those posters that you talked about. And now I have a context. I can really understand my partner's experience. And now I can begin to heal that. Now I can make change. Now I have a blueprint of where to go.
That's right. I think it lifts the shame for these individuals too, because they've been asking that question. How did I get myself here? How did I cause that much pain? How did I wind up becoming this person or acting this way? And the answers they get about that are because I'm messed up, because I'm an addict, because I had a bad childhood, or because I'm a narcissist, or because I'm avoidantly attached, or whatever. And while those things may be true in any combination for one person or one individual, some of those things may not be true. At the end of the day, what's true across the board for somebody who has gotten into betrayal violence territory is that they've maintained a relationship with their partner while secretly and repeatedly violating fidelity. And then they've used deception, gaslighting, and exploitation to conceal that information. And in doing so, that is exactly and precisely what creates the power differential. And so it is so helpful for these people to find a non-psychologically based issue to understand the conduct, the precise conduct that led to the culmination of all their power and control. And that's the starting place then for them to be able to dissolve it, is understanding how they built it up in the first place.
Are you familiar, Hope, with Dr. Manuela's metaphor of the secret sexual basement?
Yes, that's the one that I think most people love the most and benefit. I've had so many clients find that so helpful.
It's really, really helpful. I love this metaphor. It makes so much sense. And I think it also really helps to explain this idea of coercion and control, domination and control. You know, the idea is that there is, you know, a family that lives on the first floor of this house, and everybody knows how many rooms are in that house and the layout and all that stuff. And one of the family members builds this basement, right? That's hidden from the rest of the family. Nobody else knows it's there. And let's leave the world of sexual betrayal for a moment, and let's go into drugs. And let's pretend that this person who's created the basement is now making methamphetamine downstairs in the basement and denying that they're causing harm to the people that are above, you know, upstairs in the house. And now you have, let's say, a partner or a parent and the kids sitting at the table, and they're not feeling very well. And they don't know why they're not feeling very well, but they're not, right? Because maybe they are experiencing or feeling the fumes that are coming from down in the basement, but they have no context to understand that. And then the person who built the basement comes up and is sitting over dinner with the family, and the family share with him, you know, that they're not feeling well and something's wrong. And this person, desperate to keep the basement hidden, says, "What do you mean? No, there's no smell. No. And denies it, that like ongoing, consistent denial of their reality. And that continues to just decimate their own intuition, their beliefs about what they think to be true, their reality. And something that I've seen really interesting that happens occasionally when someone hears this metaphor is they'll say, "Well, you know, I go to 12-step meetings and I hear other people talk about things and their basement is so much worse." And what I say, and I hope everyone listening can really, really, really hear this and take this in, it does not matter what you are doing in the basement. It does not matter how often you are visiting the basement. If there's a basement, then there's abuse. That's probably a pretty good place to end.
Yeah, because I have goosebumps and I have nothing left to say after that.
Well, what I would like to ask is for anybody who is in the Michigan area, how can they find you if they're looking for therapeutic support?
Well, my website is hoperay.com. So that's R-A-Y, hoperay.com. And I'm also on TikTok, which is so fun. I just got on there this past year and I love it. I do have a bit of a wait list for clients, but there's plenty of good resources, including my Getting Dire Straight program. So that's a program that is, you know, the methodology I see that works well for men to rehabilitate their abusive behavior and communication. It is a program designed specifically for men at this time. So that's there, though, on my website.
Thank you. I really encourage people to reach out because, first of all, you have such an incredible methodology that you've created, or actually a framework. That's the word that we're using. It's a framework that you've created. And you're so dynamic when you talk about it. And I think people want to hear from you and they want to hear more. So I really hope that they find you. I also want to just say that I recognize that we have been talking today about a paradigm that really is more about men. And I know that there are a lot of our listeners who are actually male betrayed partners and, you know, women who have betrayed their partners, whether they identify as addicts or not. And so I do want to say that obviously betrayal, violence, and abuse does apply to women who betray or who are unfaithful. So we did not necessarily get into that today, but I really do want to validate that experience. I don't want anybody to leave this or turn this off saying, "Wow, they didn't really get me." Or because I am a male who's been betrayed, I haven't experienced that kind of abuse. And no, you have. You have, and we know that.
Mm-hmm. We could have a whole nother conversation on that if you'd like. I would love to do that with you, Marnie. Yeah, betrayal violence creates ease for us to slip into those binary pronouns. And that also has to do with the systemic inequities that exist that would make the dynamic between men and women, where the man is the betrayer and the woman is the betrayed partner, to already have some predisposed power differentials. So, you know, that's why it's easy to talk about this. And that's part of why my program that I've developed for rehab here targets men, because that's the widest population, at least that's coming to me. But there are others who need to take a look at their detachment, incongruence, regression, and entitlement. That's the acronym I call DIRE, that really undergirds this duplicitous living. And it is not gender specific. I'm so glad you mentioned that. And I'll just cap it off by saying that this is a tough one for a lot of people to hear this information. It can be a lot to digest or to hold yourself in light of this lens and consider that perhaps you've been victimized by betrayal violence or have caused your partner to become a victim in this way. And so, you know, help is on the way. There is good programs already out there. But when it comes to learning more about this, that's the hope, is that together as clients and therapists, we can spread this information to create and cohere the understanding of power dynamics that play into infidelity, so that in 5 years from now, 10 years from now, we're going to have a much more cohesive field and all the same great resources we already have, plus many more.
Well, thank you for bringing something so important, but so underspoken, misunderstood, not thought about, whatever it is, something that needed to be pulled in to the light. You've really done a wonderful job of that. And I'm grateful to you for that. And I think of you as being a pioneer in our field with all of this and all the great work you're doing.
Well, that means a lot. And Marnie, you're right there alongside me in that. You know, the goal would be to get this term out into the world so I don't have to be a face behind it any longer, because it really just needs to be kind of a public domain understanding. But thank you. Thank you for your contributions. You know, we met when you were a founding member of APSATS back years ago. I was in the very first training cohort of APSATS back when the Wild West was even wilder.
I remember it well.
Yes. And so, you know, that kinship I share with you, I just feel it palpably right now. I care so much for you and I'm grateful for your work. And thanks for this opportunity to be with you today.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And I will accept your invitation to come back and to talk again. I think that would be really wonderful.
Good. Let's do it.
All right. Everybody, thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you for listening to the Helping Couples Heal episode. And we will be back again soon. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Helping Couples Heal podcast, where your healing is our number one priority. If you'd like additional resources about betrayal trauma or to learn more about our coaching services, please visit helpingcouplesheal.com or call 562-379-4325. Our help is available worldwide. Please support Helping Couples Heal in continuing to reach others impacted by betrayal trauma by leaving a review on iTunes and sharing this podcast with someone you care about. For additional support, follow us on Instagram and consider joining our Helping Couples Heal private Facebook community. This isn't an easy journey, but you don't have to do it alone. Once again, thank you for listening.